The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
You're listening to Ruthie's Table 4 in partnership with Montclair.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the River Cafe. I can't think of a nicer place to be on a sunny spring morning than here. We have a live audience for this very special episode that features Sarah Jessica Parker, hosted by, of course, Ruthie Rogers. Enjoy the interview, and we'll be taking questions later.
The first time that Sarah Jessica Parker and I spoke, the tables were turned. She was on the phone in the River Cafe kitchen, and I was on a beach in Mexico. It was really hard to hear her with the noise of pots and pans, the crashing waves of the Pacific Ocean, but her dazzling warmth traveled the 6,000 miles. If the phone connection was poor, the friendship connection was instant. Last Sunday, she was in the River Cafe with her family, and I was there with mine. They were sitting on table one, just a few feet from the pink wood oven, close to the drama of the kitchen, and there she was, dazzling and warm. How does all this work, Ruthie? How do you make sure that Matthew's ravioli comes out the same time as my asparagus bagna cauda? This kitchen, she said, feels like the inside of a pinball machine with energy bouncing between the different stations. How do you all have the energy to do both lunch and dinner? Now, I suppose if I went backstage to Plaza Suite, the play that Sarah is doing here with her husband, Matthew Broderick, I would have similar questions. How does this work, Sarah? What do you do if someone forgets their lines? And how do you all have the energy to do a matinee and an evening performance? Today, we're here, not miles apart, inches apart, two friends together, surrounded by all of you great people. What a connection.
Thank you, Richard.
So, here we are. Did you ever work in a restaurant?
No, but I say this knowing how hard it is. I think I would really love to be a server.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really think that I know how hard it is.
We're a bit worried about this summer. Yeah, she is higher.
We were really admiring your servers the other day because I said to the girls, I was like, I'm not sure that I've seen servers move this fast in a long time because Sunday is a very busy day for you guys, right? Yeah. Like, especially
That day was a really busy day.
And I was saying to somebody, and I said, you know, I don't get to come to the River Cafe very often. I don't live in London. And to myself, to Matthew, it's like a special thing. It's like something you earn or maybe you work toward or you pine about and then you visit it and you're not sure if you made it all up. Like, is it possible that you joined a sort of cult, like a kind of thinking about it? Can it be? And then you come here, my hand to God, it is. And the kitchen really is, it's extraordinary to watch. It is like a pinball machine, but it's like, there's such precision about it. And I love watching the chefs talk to each other quickly in passing or actually come together to speak. I don't know. It's amazing. Well, and it's glorious. Well, we were thrilled to be here, really.
Well, we were thrilled to have you. And I also, when we first did the completely open kitchen, you will remember after the fire, Richard Eyre, who's a director of theater, came in and I said, Richard, isn't this just like theater, you know, watching everyone around? And he said, actually, Ruthie, it isn't. It's like ballet. And he said, because watching people, everybody, you can't shout in an open kitchen. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes you raise your voice. But basically, you're moving around to speak to people about, if you need to. I mean, usually there's a kind of communication.
And this time I had the ravioli with the spinach and the ricotta and those tiny, gorgeous porcini mushrooms that are like a surprise. They don't talk about that as much. And we ordered two, and I was like, my daughter said, do you think we can order another one? James Wilkie said, can we order another one? Which just seems so, like, gluttonous and decadent and greedy. And then I was like, you know what? Yes. And if anybody says anything, I'll just say, we'll take it. Like, I'm sorry that we're being so, like animals about this. But it's a kind of, it's good to think of it as this kind of once in a lifetime. It's just incredible.
One of the things I think that we all, probably everyone in this room would think about was that in Sex and the City, in the way you talk about food, the joy, so many conversations were over food, and it was the pleasure of food. It was enjoying food as a way of communicating, of being together, which we, you know, we all feel here, that we, a restaurant is a place where you share, you know, food, you're sitting down at the table or at home with your children.
Yeah.
And so how is that working in Sex and the City and doing, was that from you? Was
I always love food scenes. I think it initially, it was initially in place, I think probably from either Candace's original source material or Darren Starr wrote that first coffee shop scene, which I think was just a great meeting place to sort of talk about the themes of the of each episode, like get the headline out, and then each person, those kind of archetypal characters, would share points of view, so we knew where everybody stood, and it allowed for controversial conversation or titillating conversation. But I will say this, that Cynthia Nixon, who is a dear friend of mine, and we've been working together since we were little girls. We've known each other since we were 11 or 10.
Where did
she was a child actor also, and we would always audition together. She often got the part. But we played siblings when I was very young. We played sisters on records. They used to do records of stories. Mm-hmm. And we played Laura and Mary Ingalls. And then we played siblings of, we played children of Vanessa Redgrave in a movie. But Cynthia and I, in those coffee shop scenes, we always eat.
Yeah.
We always eat. Yeah. And we always need to, like, reprop our plate. And then when we finally wrap, they'll always, they always said to Cynthia, me and Cynthia, do you guys want to take it to go again today? We're like, yes, we do. So we really like those scenes. Yeah. And we very much go back and forth about what you could, they'll send the menu in advance now that we all have the phones and things, and because they want you to order in advance for props to have everything ready and multitude, you know, multiples of it. So we'll go back and forth. What'd you order? Are you going to order? They'll all order that. So you order that and we can share. So the food is like, the lines are blurred.
It's kind of the joy of food though, wasn't it?
Yes,
it was
absolutely
a way of women eating, you know.
Yes.
It was something that we are all thinking about, how we combine, you know, food. And I think it's changed. You find that your daughters are different now in terms of their attitude?
Yeah. I mean, I never was very disciplined about it. I just wasn't. I think I'm not really good at, like, denying myself something. And I think also I was a dancer for so long and running around. So it was, I was able to be that way. It's certainly not the same now. But I also just, when I had girls, I just was so, I didn't want them to have a relationship with food that was antagonistic, or they felt like this was their enemy and that they were going to have to sort of like stake out a position with food. So when I was growing up, we weren't allowed sugar in the house, and we were allowed cookies, and we weren't allowed the chocolate. And of course, all we did the minute we moved out was buy Entenmann's cakes and cookies and, you know, and I didn't want that. So in our house, we have cookies, we have cake, we have everything. And I think as a result, you kind of have a healthier relationship. And my daughters will have the figures they have, and hopefully they'll be healthy, and they're athletes, and they enjoy food, and they have different palates, and you can't make someone like something they don't like or want. And I hope that they can maintain their affection for the experience and their delight in taste and find their own ways to have that be healthy for them.
And your son.
He's absolutely mad for food. It's insane.
It was fantastic to meet. All three of them were just, you know, involved in the food and talking about the food and asking questions about the food on Sunday. You know, is Matthew cook?
Matthew cooks. We both cook every single day.
Every day?
Every single day. Every day. We probably eat dinner as a family every night.
Yeah.
If I'm shooting or he's doing a play, obviously that shifts around. We always have dinner Sunday night. But one of us, if we're home, cooks every single day. And we love to cook, and it's boring to keep saying to each other, what are we going to eat? What are we going to eat? Are you going to go to the grocery store? Am I going to go to the market? But it's kind of just what we do. Yesterday,
What did you eat last night?
Last night, we went to a restaurant in Chinatown really quickly after the show. But I had made, during the day, I made lamb stew, and Matthew made a white bean soup. So we knew we had that. I actually was bringing some to my son, but I like to have it in the fridge for matinee days.
Yeah.
And but we cook every night because I don't know why. We never understood order. We didn't get ordering in time, and now we're too old I don't know how to use a thing.
Yeah.
And every now and then we're really beaten. We'll say, should we, but I'll still call a restaurant and order it.
Send a taxi to pick it up.
We pick it up or they deliver it. But but we love cooking. I don't know why.
Do you think that's part of the drama? Do you think it's part of theater, a part of being an actor, that it's separate from what you do? Is it a time? I know that when I was working, I would always come home and everybody would say, sit down and relax. And I found the most kind of relaxing thing to do was to cook.
To be in the kitchen.
Yeah.
It is. It's. We always wonder about the post-meal part. Like, we're always like, wow, now we have to do all this. All the cleaning and stuff. So that kind of punctures some of the kind of helium of it. But I don't know if it's so much relaxing as it's just kind of what we do. It's like what's expected. Mm. What else is the family going to do if we don't get in the kitchen? And in New York, like here in London, you can run out at the last minute. You can make a meal quickly. It's not as, it doesn't seem as such a big effort in a way. Mm. And often things just taste better than if you're ordering in. In our opinion, we don't think of ourselves highly as chefs or anything, not like that. But I don't know. Our children always, I will say, they always say, wow, we're really lucky. We have dinner every night.
Yeah. But when you're in a play, do you eat before the performance or after?
I eat a huge meal after.
So do you go on stage hungry? I mean, or empty?
A little bit. I'll have yogurt, bananas. There's these eggs here that I'm in love with that I go mad for.
Oh.
The ones I want to put in my suitcase, but I know I'm not allowed. They're called Burford.
Burford, yeah.
They have those orange yolks that are just, oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So we go through a lot of those. I eat those, bananas. I'll have some lamb stew or barley and some meat. I love your rashers here, your bacon, streaky bacon. And kofta from our local butcher is really nice.
I think it's time for our first question from our audience, which Sad is going to read.
I used to work at the River Cafe, and every night I felt like customers had a different collective character. Saturday night was different from Tuesday night, and it was not the same every Saturday night, but it would become a kind of dominant vibe. And then I started working in theatre, and in my mind, it was exactly the same. And I wondered what your experience of London audiences has been, and are they different to American audiences?
Well, you've described it so beautifully, whether it's in America, in New York City, or here, this sort of, I always say, what time did they all get together and decide who they were going to be tonight? Like, it's a conspiracy that they work so beautifully together, and it is a range, and a Saturday night can be boisterous and civilized, or boisterous and out of control and sort of behaving, I'm going to say poorly in quotes, but not really, but just more talkative. But generally speaking, the audiences here have been really, really lovely and very hospitable. And we weren't sure because this is a very American play by a real American playwright writing about kind of cultural familiarity to Americans, especially New Yorkers, but they've been absolutely wonderful. I think they've proven to be really great listeners, sincerely great listeners. But they do seem to have psychically agreed upon something, and I don't understand it. Like, these people probably couldn't agree about anything else if you remove them from the theater, like, as a whole. Maybe they could, I don't know. But it is unique.
And I think that is in a restaurant, don't you think? That we can sense.
Yeah.
You can sort of cook the same food, the same time, the same with the same team.
Yeah.
You can go home at 10 o'clock and think, I'm a failure. You know, this is a dead end.
You,
or you
really?
Think this was one of the greatest nights of my life.
Yeah.
It's just so hard to.
It is. And it's, I think, the human part of all of this is the thing that's just hard to pin down. Like, you can't do the same show. You have a good show and you're trying to sort of always mimic that. Or in the kitchen, you'll have a great. And you're always trying to, but it is human. So it's never going to be the same. It's never going to last as long. The pause isn't going to get a laugh, or maybe it will. Or, and that's the, I think that's what is, makes it so exciting for a diner, or hopefully for an audience, is they are very much a part of it. They are a significant 50% of the relationship is the diner to your chefs and your servers and you and us with our audience, our playwright, our words, our director, and this audience. Like, we have to, they have to be our partner for the night. And they show that in various ways.
Did you know the River Cafe has a shop? It's full of our favorite foods and designs. We have cookbooks, linen napkins, kitchenware, tote bags with our signatures, glasses from Venice, chocolates from Turin. You can find us right next door to the River Cafe in London or online at shoptherivercafe.co.uk.
There's a lot happening these days. But I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters, without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
So, Sarah, you've just made Punterelle.
Yes.
All of a matter with Sean.
There is something to me about Punterelle salad that it really blows my mind. And it's very hard to get in New York for anybody who lives in New York. Punterelle is like contraband. Like, apparently it's not allowed, or and when it is, there's like, you have like 4 days to enjoy it. And to have it here sort of like at your whim, to me, is such decadence.
This is a punterelle, but I've never seen it in
its natural state.
Be smaller, because we were in Turin last week, weren't we, Ruthie? And they were huge, massive heads of it. It's actually a chicoria. Do you know what? It's like a chicoria plant.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can either use the outside leaves and just chop them up and boil them as a vegetable.
Oh, really?
And then this is like the bulb in the middle.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this
interesting.
Is actually the bulb of the whole plant.
Oh, my God.
And inside it is these things that look like fingers. So what you generally do is just, well, you can cut them off or pull them off.
Do you have to soak them or anything?
Yeah, it's all in the soaking.
Right.
This goes in iced water, mm-hmm. and it goes in iced water for about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns into... Hang on, bear with me, Corlett.
No, you're okay.
Oh, yeah, here. It's going to go all crunchy like this. And it crisps up.
I see.
So once you've cut it, just put it in ice water. So the dressing, I'll make the dressing for one.
Is that garlic?
Yeah, I'll put a tiny bit.
That's whatever you want. Don't change anything on my account. What is that beautiful?
That's chili.
Oh, it's chili. Oh, gorgeous.
A tiny bit of chili, like a tiny bit. And then these anchovies that are really...
Those anchovies are so beautiful.
A bit more pepper in. I'll just touch my hand. Probably about that much olive oil. This is actually making... It's going to be super well-dressed.
Oh, my God, it's so gorgeous.
This is just your dressing.
Oh, it's so gorgeous.
And it is literally as simple as this.
Now, how dry? Did I get them dry enough in your estimation?
I think so. Okay. Yeah. But, I mean, it just depends.
It's heaven.
As much anchovy as you like, as much vinegar as you like, really.
So, Sarah, read the recipe. Read it
Should
any
I
way
just
you want.
Tell you that... No. It's absolutely divine.
Good.
And it was on Sunday. Two heads of punterelle. Am I saying it correctly, punterelle?
You're saying it perfectly.
Five salted anchovies cleaned, and your wonderful chef used Spanish anchovies. Two tablespoons of red wine vinegar, one garlic clove chopped, and then she did this gorgeous thing with her knife where she sort of smeared
she
it.
She Sean, who's right there.
Sean, I'm sorry, Sean. She sort of took her knife and mashed it and... made it a wonderful kind of misery. One garlic clove chopped, as I've said, two dried chilies, one teaspoon of black pepper, four tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil. And then to prepare the punterelle, fill a bowl with ice-cold water, adding a few ice cubes. Pull the hollow buds from the punterelle heads, I guess, once they're out of that and nice and clean and crisp. Slice the buds very thinly lengthwise and place in the water to crisp until they curl up. This will take about an hour. Add the garlic to the anchovies with the crumbled chilies and the pepper. Add the olive oil. Spin dry the punterelle and place in a bowl and mix with the anchovy sauce.
Simple.
Perfection. Perfection.
I'm curious about when you first had punterelle. Did that punterelle was Cincinnati?
In Cincinnati. No. Well, I moved to New York when I was a very little girl, but... we can talk about the vegetables that were available in Cincinnati, but the first time we had it, there was a wonderful little restaurant that didn't last very long, and it was on McDougal and I can't remember the cross street, right off of 6th Avenue, and it was on the menu, and Matthew and I actually just read the ingredients or the description, and we thought, well, of course, we'll try it, and it was absolutely beautiful. And so then we sort of... Like, we're chasing it, I guess, a wee bit like truffles, like waiting for that moment, you know?
Yeah, that is Italian food. You have it, then you say goodbye and say hello.
That's what
to
makes
the
it so
asparagus.
Special, yeah.
Yeah, but going back to Cincinnati, tell us about 8 children.
I'm one of 8, yes.
Yeah.
And
wow.
In Cincinnati, we at that point, we had only 6. My mother was pregnant with the baby girl. When we moved to New York City, on January 1st of 1977. So I've lived there most of my life. My real father is from Brooklyn, born and raised. So we spent some time before that in Brooklyn visiting my grandparents on my father's side. But food was, for a lot of my siblings, we think and talk and share feelings, thoughts, experiences with food. I would say in some way it dominates our relationship. Like it's the thing that we, I would say maybe with books as well, but food probably even more so. And we all have a different relationship with it. Some of us cook, some of us don't. Some of us have money to explore restaurants that would be more rarefied and some don't. But food is... And always has been in my memory, this destination. And I always want to have something I've never had. Yeah. Always.
But did your mother, did she cook? What were mealtimes like?
She cooked. We had dinner every single night.
All of you, all 7 or 6 of you?
Eventually all 8. My mother would probably say that she really didn't care. She didn't enjoy cooking. She didn't come from a family that enjoyed food. And I think with eight kids, it was work versus joyful. Mm-hmm. But simultaneously, she loved food. And she, as a young woman, went off to New York City as an employee of Procter & Gamble, which is a big company in Cincinnati, Ohio. You know, like a lot of girls straight out of college got a job at Procter & Gamble and was sent to New York to be a salesperson. And her first stop was always Chinatown, always Chinatown. She loved Chinatown. She loved Chinese food. She loved anything that was different. And there was
this
a place.
This would be in the 60s.
This would be in the 50s. Late 50s, mid to late 50s. And there was a place called Dave's Luncheonette that was a very famous place. You just stopped by and had an egg cream after having Chinese food. And so she, of course, she grew up reading the New Yorker. The librarians from the time she was a little girl would save her the weekly New Yorker. So she would read about food. And she would read about Chinatown. And she would read about places in the outer boroughs. And so for her, food was this thing that was part of another life that she hoped to give all of us. And so even though she didn't like cooking, and she cooked, you know, three meals a day, we all helped with breakfast, lunch, and breakfast and dinner, lunch in the summers.
Did your mother work? Did she manage to feed seven or eight children every day and work, or did she?
She was a school teacher up until a few months after I was born, and then I think that was her last year. She taught second grade. At the time, we lived in a very little city in southeastern Ohio. This was before Cincinnati. It was in the foothills of Appalachia, actually. And so she taught second grade, but her students could be anywhere from 7 to 14 years old, depending upon how much time they'd been afforded to be in school. And so she stopped teaching for many, many years and just not just. She was a mother, which consumed all her time. Yeah. And then she started her own preschool for many, many years. She had her own school in New Jersey. It was a sort of Montessori. She's a progressive educator. And she retired from that about 10 years ago. And she just came to London to visit. My father passed away a year ago, so she's newly.
Was there anybody helping her? Did your father ever go, or your stepfather ever go in the kitchen? And did anybody
else
cook?
Everybody. It was our job to be
helpful. So you come home from school, do your homework, and then help get the dinner ready.
Yes. Well, we came home from school. We did some homework.
Sort of.
And then we had ballet classes. And so when we come home from ballet, then we'd all jump in and help in the kitchen. We all had jobs before and after dinner that wasn't necessarily connected to cooking. It was cleaning, putting things away, sweeping, loading the dishwasher, unloading the dishwasher, helping with laundry. But even though it was labor, we all came out of that house, for the most part, really loving food and willing to try anything. And if I travel, sometimes I say, I'm only going to try, like, I'll take a job. I think, well, I'm really taking this just so I can go eat this. And, you know, if you are on a holiday and you go trying to find restaurants, and I do endless months of research, like, where? And then you get to your destination and you'll try to ask people and they'll send you the place that everybody else in the hotel is going or everybody else. And I'll say, no, please. Where do you eat, Mr. Concierge, Miss Concierge? Where do you eat? And they won't tell me because they think we want this stacked food, fancy, you know. And so I'll just follow the employees home.
I literally follow
them home.
Yeah.
And then I see where they live and their communities and their restaurants.
Yeah.
And that's where I go. And that's where I shop.
Yeah.
Hardware stores, you know.
Maybe you could just stay with the employees.
But that's where, like, the good food is.
Save you some hotel bills and just, because...
Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Richard, my husband, used to always go to bookstores. He would get into Verona or a little town in the south of Spain or Italy, and he'd always, for some reason, he would always think that people who worked in bookstores would know where to eat.
Right.
You know? And,
and probably where they like to eat.
And finding those places that means something to people.
I think finding that local experience, it completes the experience in a way that sometimes you can't have if you don't know. You know, like when a local person gives you directions and you realize, oh, they're giving me directions without realizing how little I know.
Yeah.
you describe to someone how to get on Bleecker, you'd have to say, listen, Bleecker's going to go left and right and up and down. You have to give them those.
Yeah.
So when you get to eat local, you're like having their experience.
Yeah. I asked quite a few actors whether, when they took a part, whether they would not so much choose the part. That's kind of extreme. It's about the what restaurants were there. But quite a few of them did research before going to shoot a film in Budapest or Venice or wherever they were before they went to find out, you know, where to eat.
Yeah.
Because it's important, isn't it? When
you're
making a movie, to feel part of the community.
Yeah, wherever you get.
The markets.
I think wherever you get to travel for whatever reason, if you can somehow try to embed a little bit in the local flavor of a community, I don't know, sometimes I've been, you know, for work, you have to travel a lot and you do like these things like press junkets, you know, and especially in the old days, they do these big grand world tours and you'd be given a guide, which was all wonderful. And I was super grateful. But then I would just say to the guide, like, no, stop the van now. Stop the van now. I want to get out here. And they're like, well, there's just houses here. And I was like, yes, exactly. I just want to see the houses. You know, I don't know. You feel like you're seeing something versus the same boulevard with the fancy shops and the fancy restaurants.
Time for our question from our audience.
What happens on an aeroplane when you have a long distance flight? Because I cannot imagine the cuisine exciting you. Do you bring your own food?
Depends on the airline. Like, I think a lot of the Asian airlines have really, really, really good food. Aer Lingus, I love their food. But I will bring, I always have snacks in my bag. I always have meat sticks that I love, like, you know, healthy. They're not. I'll bring stuff that I think will get me through a flight I might have some feelings, some concerns. I can't bear the idea of being hungry. Yeah. I just, like, meaning, let me rephrase that. If I can help that not be true, I will keep up my end. You know what I mean? But I don't mind trying anything on an airline. In the old days when I was telling when we used to do these big press junkets, we were always flying to Japan. And I will say that food on Japan airline was like, what? I would just stay up just to eat. They're like, would you like to rest? And I was like, absolutely not. I would like to eat and digest and then start the next offering. Like, what else is on this menu?
If you like listening to Ruthie's Table 4, would you please make sure to rate and review the podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
When I was growing up, we all went to restaurants for a special occasion, you know, a birthday, an anniversary, or my mother just being possibly too tired to cook. But it was a rare occasion that we went. And here in the River Cafe, we see people coming in for Saturday lunch, Sunday lunch, early dinners, late dinners, and kids are ordering. And there is a breadth of children and young people eating out, you know, and that.
They're more used to it than I ever was. I mean, it was such a big deal to eat out for us growing up, and we certainly get to. And we get to travel in a way that my family didn't take vacations. We didn't go on a holiday, not until much later. And then it was, you know, you're sharing a house with another family, and you're still cooking all your meals. You wouldn't, you know, we would go to the Outer Banks of North Carolina. This was 40 years ago. More. And it was this sort of very pristine, not very popular destination, and so the big deal for us was that we would get crab and throw down newspaper, and you know, and that was a big deal. That was like eating out. But my children, when they came to London to visit, we went out the first night, and they were like, oh my gosh, we haven't been to a restaurant in so long. It's so exciting to be at a restaurant. So it's still exciting, but it's certain they're definitely more familiar with it than I ever was
and
as
you
a child.
Quite, I mean, I think another similarity is that we both like our neighborhoods. You know, that we like a neighborhood.
Yes.
I like a neighborhood.
I love neighborhoods.
And, you know, when we moved, it's not where I live isn't quite the West Village, but it, in a sense, it doesn't have perhaps a lot of the character that you have, but it is place that you want to be involved in. So they call up, you know, we called the local theater and said, we're here, you know, what can we do? Or I know you do that with your neighborhood.
Yeah.
And your neighborhood being the West Village is probably full of restaurants, isn't it? Do you eat local?
It is. We do.
Do you go to the same place over and over again?
We do. And especially, you know, after the pandemic, we were really concerned. There were a lot of small businesses and restaurants included in that were not part of larger consortiums that were really really struggling. I'm sure you all had it here as well. And it was so easy to be supportive because they're our neighbors and we know their family stories or the stories of the restaurants. And we knew, you know, the collateral damage. Like if something closes, it's not just that. It's everything around it that kind of lives and breathes off of it. And so it's very easy to do it, not just out of, you know, desire to be a good citizen and a neighbor, but because they're wonderful restaurants. They're wonderful restaurants. And some are old and not inventive at all. You know, they're not like rethinking or deconstructing Italian food, but they've been in business since 1978, you know. And then there's newer chefs that are doing really exciting things. And then you've got your local little delis and bodegas and everything in between, and it's a real privilege to live among them and to say that we are patrons and that we mean it, you know.
There's so much to talk about. Can you tell us about the wine?
Yes. So I was asked, it's now 6 years ago, 7 years ago, by these two young gentlemen in New Zealand producing Sauvignon Blanc out of the Marlborough region, which is not that surprising, if I would like to work with them and partner with them. And I was absolutely confounded because I didn't know anything about the wine business except that one of the reasons my husband and I like to travel is to taste local wine. And I thought, like most of us, that you have to come from generations of wine families, and the language I thought I would never understand, and I thought it was really only for the rarefied few. But they said no. And I said, well, if you'll let me really learn and really be as informed as possible, then we can start talking about it. And of course they did. And it's been an amazing experience. We're in our sixth vintage on our Sauvignon Blanc. It's been picked in the top 100 wines in the world for the second time. It's won all sorts of awards. Like I don't say this about my acting work ever. Like I wouldn't say like I've won it, because I haven't. But I'm so proud of this because we've worked really hard, and it's been, the Sauvignon Blanc's been so beautifully received, and our rosé has been beautifully received, and we've never, I think, done below a 93 in Wine Spectator, which is a big deal in our that business. And we're about to launch our Pinot Noir, which is, it's so gorgeous. So it's been amazing. Yeah. And I really love them, and I love the wine. So, yeah, we just keep working really hard. And I do all the blendings, and it's been incredible. It's been a great education.
If we were to say in this, you know, conversation that food is fun, and it's exciting, and it sustains us, and we share it, and we cook for our children as an expression of love, it's also comfort. If you do need comfort, is there a food that you would turn to, Sarah Jessica Parker?
Yes, I would say that pork chops. Mm. And I would just describe them more specifically as saying thin-cut pork chops on the bone, not fancy, not from your most special butcher, but from Gristiti's. Mm-hmm. Like simple. Put them in the pan with olive oil and salt and pepper, and heaven. I don't know why I love it. My brother loves them too, but bringing up a very close competitor is probably lamb chops, which I make probably two or three times a week.
Do you?
I make pork chops at least twice a week, and we here I've made lamb.
How do you make your lamb chops?
I'm kind of embarrassed because it's not.
Don't be.
Because I do the lamb chops. Mm-hmm. We use Kerrygold butter. Mm-hmm. Anyone know Kerrygold butter?
Yeah, we all do.
There's so much unsalted butter in London, it's kind of hard to find the salted. So I use Kerrygold butter and just a touch of olive oil so the butter doesn't burn. And I salt and pepper the baby lamb chops and I throw them in, and that's it. And they are just that you can taste all the fat, you can smell the fat when it's cooking, and we eat a lot of lamb in Ireland, and I've bought lamb here from our local butcher.
You go to
two or
Ireland.
Three times a week.
You have a house in Ireland?
Yeah.
Where, tell us just about
it's
that.
It's way up in County Donegal, so it's way up northwest, and my husband's been going there since he was a little boy, and I've been going there since we were together, which is 30 years, and we finally, you know, bought our own little house because he shares his family home with his siblings, and they have all grown children, and they have children, and so yeah, we go there a lot.
What is the food like?
The best potatoes. It really is like a cliche, but it's true. Mm. The greatest, greatest, greatest potatoes ever, especially if you're there for the new potato season, is it's heaven. Mm. Kerrygold butter, York cabbage. I don't know what it is about a York cabbage that blows my mind. Lamb. Yeah. The eggs, the rashers.
Yeah.
Any root stuff there is really
good. Do you
grow? We don't. We're not there enough to take care of it and really earn it, you know, someday. Yeah. But, white toast, baby batch. Anyone know what a baby batch is? No. It would be forbidden in my house growing up. Like, we were not allowed to have white bread growing up. It's just bread slices, like, the kids like it. You make sandwiches for when company comes over. But there's a beautiful brown soda bread there that you
soda
just
bread.
Get it in the, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That we eat crazy. And that we can get in the States. We can get a bunch of the food in the States now. And
Greece?
We can get Kerrygold butter.
You go to Greece?
Greece is my Greece is my favorite place outside of any place else. And it's maybe the food. I think there's nothing better than a Greek salad in Greece and lamb chops. Mm. But I just think the people, the history, the culture, the art, the way it looks, just seeing Greece for the first time and seeing white against blue, against sky, against the sea. I don't know. I think it's probably a place that I would spend many, many months a year if I could. Like, everywhere. Okay. Yeah.
You have been part of so many award-winning productions over the years, whether it's film or television or theatre. I would love to hear about one of your favourite celebratory meals.
Well, it happened to be my brother's birthday, but that was coincidental. But he's my oldest brother, and he's kind of a very important figure in our lives growing up. And I had been, like, researching for a really long time Georgian and Russian restaurants in Brooklyn, but, like, the real stuff. Like, because there's a massive Georgian and Russian community, as you guys probably know, in Brooklyn, and it's way, 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 way out. Like, you know, could be 30 stops on the train. But you make like a pilgrim. It's like a big deal. Well, it was for me. And I had been researching and researching. And then this day appeared. And I was like, this is the day I'm going to do it. So I called my brother Pippin because he's one of the siblings that goes crazy for the food like me. And I said to Matthew, like, let's just do it. And so we went out on this long train ride, which was fantastic because you're under and over. And we had Georgian food. Deep, 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 deep Brooklyn. And it was my brother's birthday, so it was really great. And he had to go around the corner and buy, you know, spirits or wine or something. But that was an unbelievable meal. Unbelievable meal. Yeah, it was everything. That's what I could think of.
I just wanted to ask about the joy of going to a restaurant that's comforting, like Jeans.
Jeans? Did you say Jeans? Who is that? Oh, hi.
Oh, Jeans is in a restaurant.
Yeah.
About Jeans.
Jeans is a wonderful restaurant on 11th Street in the West Village, very near City and Country. Seemingly a little bit, like, not fancy room. It's this beautiful room, terribly low ceiling, one of the prettiest bars you'll ever see in New York City. It's got marble steps. You walk down to it, and this gorgeous bar greets you that's been around for however long this is. Do the math. I can't do it. Famously good bartender. Locals sit there and eat, and the food is like veal scallopini, tomato sauce. But they are one of those places that, remember when you did the thing with Danny Meyer and he talked about how these restaurants in New York put out the stainless steel platter with the cold vegetables on the ice cubes? So you get to your table and it's got big radishes and carrot sticks and celery, hearts of celery and fennel. Yeah. It's gorgeous. It's like easy, wonderful, and everybody in there is an older group and they're so lovely. They'll all say, you know, we're going to go see your show. You know, we read about the book or, you know, they're very community oriented and it's a wonderful place. And we go there a lot on Sunday nights. Like if we're meeting other people, if we're not going to invite people to our house for dinner, we'll go to Jeans.
Okay. You have to go to Jeans.
Beautiful cocktails.
Shall we eat? Are we hungry? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Ruthie's Table 4 in partnership with Montclair.
Ruthie's Table 4 is produced by Atomai Studios for iHeartRadio. It's hosted by Ruthie Rogers and it's produced by Willa Malensky. This episode was edited by Julia Johnson and mixed by Nigel Appleton. Our executive producers are Faye Stewart and Zad Rogers. Our production manager is Caitlin Paramore and our production coordinator is Bella Cellini. This episode had additional contributions by Sean Wynne Owen. Thank you to everyone at the River Cafe for your help in making this episode.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit RightRug.com. That's RiteRug.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.